Nuclear icon. We all come into our awareness of nuclear dangers from somewhere or someone. And for me, as for so many of you listening, that awareness came from Dr. Helen Caldicott. A medical doctor, for more than 60 years, she has led the world in awareness, organizing, and fighting back at the highest levels, teaching us how to fight back against the nuclear menace. Using medical information on the consequences to human life and health, she vividly explains what nuclear weapons reactors and the entire fuel chain, from uranium mining's impact on mostly indigenous people around the world to what physically happens to the human body in the wake of the bomb, she has led thought and action that at times came heartbreakingly close to banning nuclear bombs. So there's no time or energy dedicated to couching the language into something quote-unquote acceptable. When she tells you,
almost all politicians are scientifically and medically illiterate, and these people who own the bomb, and we're right on the verge of nuclear annihilation today, and I'll get onto the quotes defense industry soon, but it's not defense, it's murder. It's the Department of Murder, not defense. Murder. All these weapons they're creating, they're for murder. Murder.
Well, when Dr. Helen Caldicott, a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, states it so clearly and directly, there's no way to avoid the fact that the human race has gotten itself strapped into that terrible, deadly, radioactive seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, in light of U.S. President Trump announcing that he is ordering the resumption of nuclear testing, we learn how close the U.S. and Russia once came to abolishing nuclear weapons, and we learn it from the woman who tried so hard to make it happen, Dr. Helen Caldicott. In an extended interview, she shares the path that led her to becoming one of the preeminent voices against all things nuclear, the founder of major international anti-nuclear groups, and a leader I often refer to as the mother of us all, at least for those of us who are opposing nuclear. We will also have Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than we have yet to get on the exact nature of Trump's call to resume nuclear weapons testing. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 4th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out this week with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, which seems to come with its own side order of numbnuts. Here's Linda Pence Gunter reporting.
Are you in the mood for some free plutonium? Well, sorry, but if you aren't a friend of Donald Trump, you probably didn't get that coupon in the mail. But the executives at Oklo did. Their microreactor with the appropriate fairy tale name of Aurora, because that's fundamentally what we are dealing with here, is the first in the queue. The Aurora requires a fuel made with plutonium, and Trump has generously decided to give away at least 25 metric tons of the stuff to the commercial sector from the nation's surplus stockpile. And when the Oklo officials go to collect, guess who their benefactor will be? Former Oklo board member Chris Wright, now Trump's energy secretary. The Department of Energy has been falling all over itself to insist that there is absolutely, positively no conflict of interest here, and that Wright has definitely severed all connections with Oklo. For sure. Honest. Plutonium is the trigger component of a nuclear bomb. The countries that develop nuclear weapons have surplus piles of plutonium left over, an ever-present security threat. Several of those nuclear weapons countries also reprocess the irradiated fuel from their own and other countries' civil reactors, separating the plutonium from uranium and leaving, again, a massive surplus of plutonium with no safe destination. The US ended reprocessing under the Ford administration due to proliferation concerns. For a time, it explored repurposing some of the plutonium into mixed oxide fuel known as MOX, which combines both plutonium and uranium. But after squandering possibly as much as $12 billion in taxpayer money on a MOX fuel fabrication plant, it too was abandoned. There are still no commercial US reactors designed to use MOX fuel. The White House has announced that it will begin revealing its lucky free plutonium recipients on December 31st, based on applications received by the Department of Energy by November 21st, according to Reuters. The upwards of 25 metric tons of plutonium Trump would be redirecting into the civil nuclear sector had previously been slated for permanent disposal as nuclear waste left over from the Cold War era. Disposing of it is far cheaper than reprocessing it, $20 billion versus $49 billion, and also isolates it from potentially falling into the wrong hands. That's a point Senator Ed Markey and Representatives Don Beyer and John Garamendi, all Democrats, made in a September 10th letter they sent to Trump, in which they expressed concern about dishing out plutonium to, quote, private industry for commercial energy use. That, they said, quote, goes against long-standing bipartisan U.S. nuclear security policy. It raises serious weapons proliferation concerns, makes little economic sense, and may adversely affect the nation's defense posture, they wrote. Markey wrote to Trump again on September 23rd, specifically inquiring whether it was more than just a peculiar coincidence that Wright's former company, Oklo, would be the beneficiary of the plutonium handout, and wanting to know whether, quote, a serious conflict of interest may exist within your administration on this issue. Joining Oklo in the plutonium queue are US-based Valar Atomics and a foreign corporation, the now French-based but originally British nuclear company, Nucleo, whose reactors will not only consume but also produce plutonium. Curiously, on the very day, May 23rd, that Trump released his executive orders fast-tracking nuclear power expansion, Valar Atomics put out its own statement celebrating the news and echoing decidedly Trumpian language. Here's what they said. There's a new arm to national nuclear security, dominance. Dominance in civil nuclear technology development. Dominance in nuclear energy infrastructure deployment. Dominance in shaping global development, the Valar Atomics statement read. In case you haven't noticed, dominance is a favorite and possibly the favorite Trump word. The rhetorical coincidence certainly makes one wonder if Valar Atomics had seen the executive orders in advance, or maybe even written parts of them themselves. That's because Valar Atomics is one of the louder cheerleaders in favor of minimizing or even eliminating those annoying safety regulations. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, established to safeguard nuclear power development from harm to the public, was described in one executive order as, quote, throttling nuclear power development. And Valar Atomics heartily agrees. Quote, their rules, created in the overreaction to the Three Mile Island incident, shuttered the nuclear industry, they wrote. Simply testing a reactor prototype takes 5 to 7 years at best. This is not the way to foster innovation. To regain our dominance in nuclear energy, the status quo must change quickly. What needs to change quickly is the idea that plutonium has any place in the civil nuclear sector or anywhere else. We need to step off the plutonium pathway and fast if we want to avoid our own inevitable destruction. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Now here's this week's special featured interview. I needed to go in for a medical procedure this week. Don't worry, I'm fine. But because of it, I was unable to produce an entirely new episode. Given that President Trump has threatened to resume nuclear testing, with no specifics on whether that's atmospheric or underground explosions or delivery system testing, I think this presents a good opportunity to look back at the time this madness nearly ended, when Dr. Helen Caldicott almost convinced the United States and Russia to get rid of their nukes entirely. Her background and how she came to her preeminent position as an anti-nuclear crusader is all covered during the interview, so let's get to it. I spoke with Dr. Helen Caldicott on Monday, April 25th, 2022. Dr. Helen Caldicott, it is always a pleasure and an honor to have you as a guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much.
Let's start out with you. What is your background and how did you first become interested in and involved with nuclear issues?
Well, I'm a doctor, a physician. I've always wanted to be a doctor since I was 11. My specialty is cystic fibrosis. I learned how to treat that disease when I was on the Harvard faculty, working with the pioneer, Dr. Harry Schwachman, and I set up the first cystic fibrosis clinic in Australia in Adelaide, which now has the best longevity results in the country. How did I get involved in nuclear? Well, I had a wonderful biology teacher, Peter Martin, in first year of medicine, who taught me about the experiments on Drosophila fruit flies, where if they're irradiated, they develop in future generations genetic abnormalities like crooked wings and abnormal body structures, etc. And so I learned very early when I was only 17 about radiation and genetics. And I also read when I was 17 a book called On the Beach by Neville Shute, and it was set in Melbourne, Australia. Ava Gardner came out to film it with Gregory Peck, I think. And it was about a nuclear war that occurred by accident in the Northern Hemisphere, which could happen today. And gradually the radioactive fallout came down to the Southern Hemisphere, and the book was set in Melbourne, and the government gave cyanide capsules to parents so they could kill their babies so they wouldn't die of long, awful medical effects of acute radiation illness, vomiting and bleeding to death. And at the end of that book, everyone was dead. And that's where I lived. And that marked my soul. I understood right from the start, when I was just an adolescent, what nuclear war means. And it hasn't changed. It's just gotten worse. And we're actually on the brink of annihilation right now. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Then I did medicine, and as I said, I trained in cystic fibrosis. In 1971, the French were testing bombs in the South Pacific, and I got a message from someone that the water supply in Adelaide, where I lived, was radioactive. We were getting fallout from the French tests. So I wrote a letter to the local paper, and I said that children could get leukemia from the fallout, and that radiation like strontium-90, et cetera, concentrate in cow's milk and the like. And I just read Germaine Greer, the female eunuch, so I was very uninhibited. And I rang the editor because he didn't publish it. And I said, where's my letter? And he said, well, madam, we get hundreds a day, in a very condescending way. And I said, yeah, but this one's important. I talked him through it. He published it the next day. And then I was that night on television, national television, talking as a doctor about the medical effects of fallout. And every time the French blew up another bomb, there I was on television and radio. And what I didn't know was that the Australians don't like the French. They think they're arrogant. I've got a French son-in-law, so I'll verify that. He's a count, actually. I'm very fond of him, but he is arrogant. And there were spontaneous marches in the city streets, thousands of people with babies on shoulders and signs saying, I don't want to die of leukemia from French tests. 80% of the population were opposed. There were whole pages of letters to the editor. We'd never seen anything like it. Postal workers wouldn't deliver French mail. People stopped buying French wine, French cheese. And at the end of that, I was asked to go to Tahiti with the man who then became the Deputy Prime Minister, Jim Cairns, to talk to the French. Well, we got to the airport in Sydney and the French wouldn't allow us to embark because they said you can't disembark in Tahiti. So next minute I was on a plane flying to Paris with the Deputy Prime Minister, or who became so. and the leader of the Union of University Students. We got to Paris. We had to wait several days, and then we got to the Elysee Palace. We met with the French senior people, and they said, well, our bombs are perfectly safe. So Jim Ken said, well, if they're perfectly safe, why don't you blow them up in the Mediterranean? Their faces turned bright white, and they said, mon Dieu, there are too many people living around the Mediterranean. And so for the first time in my life, I found myself sitting opposite wicked politicians who didn't give one good damn if Australian children died of leukemia. And that was a big turning point in my life. Anyway, the pressure in Australia was so great that the Prime Minister took France to the International Court of Justice, and she was forced to test underground. Out of sight is out of mind, of course. The Tahitian people suffered terribly with cancers and the like. They were flying patients into Paris in the middle of the night so no one could see them, but the fallout stopped. So I saw what Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. So that was good. I was at the time when that court ruling occurred working 80 hours a week as a paediatric intern because I had to become qualified to become what they call a physician in Australia. In other words, to be a paediatrician. And I got a call at 5 o'clock in the morning in my room at the hospital from the Australian Broadcasting Commission telling me what had happened. And I said, well, that's good. But they were absolutely tickled pink. So that was good. Then I found out Australia wanted to mine uranium and I knew nothing about it. So I went to the library at the university and I got out a book called Poison Power by Goffman and Tamplin. These two were employed by the Atomic Energy Commission to work out if radiation was dangerous from nuclear power and the like. And it was a very scary book. I nearly developed alopecia totalis, which is total baldness as my hair fell out on the desk. So I learnt about all the isotopes made in nuclear power, how darn dangerous they were. John Goffman, who was an MD and helped to discover plutonium, he became my hero. And I went to see the Prime Minister in Parliament. He wasn't a bit interested. And I had a friend who was an engine driver and he said, Helen, let's write to all the unions in Australia. Let's write to all the unions. And at that time, most of our workforce was unionised, unlike America. You know, there were 76 unions in the state of South Australia. So we wrote to them and said, can I talk to you about the medical effects of mining uranium? They said, yeah, you can come, but we won't change. You know, we'll keep on mining uranium. Anyway, I travelled all over Australia talking to union workers at 6 o'clock in the morning in the Northern Territory before they went out, had a dirty old blackboard and a piece of chalk and dirt floor, etc., and drawing genes and testicles and how radiation induces genetic mutation. And I got around and talked to many, many union workers and miners. I went to the Mary Kathleen mine in Queensland, which was a uranium mine. And the workers said that they would tar and feather me if I went there. Well, I gave a talk, and afterwards they lined up in queues to ask me questions. They bought me drinks. After I left, they set up a health clinic and the like and the like. And then I talked to the National Union of Railway Workers in Sydney, a couple of hoary old blokes, and I thought, oh, I won't convince them. The next day, they called a 24-hour strike across Australia, a national strike, and no one could get to work on the railway. I then talked to the Trades and Labour Council in Adelaide, the compilation of all the unions. I had, I don't know, 10 minutes. They talked. They'd been drinking. They were very rude, and I thought, how am I going to get their attention? So I started talking about the medical effects of radiation upon their testicles. Well, that shut them up. And I had about 5 minutes to fill it all in. And at the end, they said, oh, my God, I don't want my kids growing up in a world like that. So they passed a resolution to send to the Prime Minister. And so what happened, I then left for America to work at Harvard for a sabbatical. But the Australian Council of Trade Unions, ACTU, very powerful body, then passed a resolution to cancel and to block mining of uranium, transport and export of uranium, which was absolutely wonderful. Then we got a Prime Minister called Bob Hawke, who used to go to the CIA and talk to them in the American embassy in Canberra, and he told the Americans he'd reverse that policy, which he did, and he brought in the three-mine policy. We'll only have three uranium mines, which is like telling a patient, well, don't worry, madam, you're just a tiny bit pregnant. He was a traitor. I was very, very annoyed with him. He's dead now. So that's my Australian experience.
You moved with your family from Australia to the United States in 1966. How much did the exposure to radiation factor in on your decision to move?
None at all. Because the French had stopped testing? No, none at all.
What brought you to the United States and what was your work here?
My husband, ex-husband, was a radiologist and he got a job at Harvard Medical School in Children's Hospital Medical Center to work and train with Ed Neuhauser, who was the most prominent pediatric radiologist in the world. We moved over there for Bill to train. I had three little children. I actually brought three children under three. He came to America for 6 months while I stayed at home and had my last baby by myself, staying with my dying mother. She was dying of rheumatoid lung disease. I got them all together and brought three children under three plus my mother to Boston so that he could go 6 months earlier to train. It was the most difficult thing I ever did. I was so tired. Anyway, when I got there, you know, I got bored and I said to Bill, can you get me a job at the Children's Hospital? And he met Harry Schwachman, who was one of the pioneers in cystic fibrosis. And I got a part-time job in the cystic fibrosis clinic. So I would get up early, bath my three babies, give them breakfast, take them to Mrs. Weisberg's, who was my babysitter, and get to Harvard by 8:30 in the morning to work. And I learned how to treat cystic fibrosis. In the interim, I was asked by some people, next door neighbors, I lived in West Newton in Massachusetts, to talk about the nuclear power and the medical effects.
They were aware of your reputation and the history
somehow,
of what you'd done.
I can't remember how. I think what I did was I wrote a letter to the Boston Globe about nuclear power. And I was interviewed by the Boston Globe, and I think I was put on the front page of the Boston Globe magazine. I was asked to speak, and at this meeting at my neighbor's place, I talked about everything I knew about nuclear power, and there was a man called Naim Siskin there who was a publisher, and he asked me to write a book, and I said, I don't want to write a book. I'm too busy anyway. And he said, look, you can talk into a tape recorder. So I said, okay. But that didn't work. I had to sit down and write, and I wrote Nuclear Madness. And it was published, and it was published just as Three Mile Island was happening. And so it sold an awful lot of books, and I became well-known. And about that time, I started Physicians for Social Responsibility in Boston.
You actually were instrumental, not only as being the roots of my activism, but the roots of my awareness of exactly how bad Three Mile Island was when I was 1 mile away from it, even for a short period of time. Because when the world seemed to either try to be ignoring or just not speaking about the consequences to a human being, I came across an article. I was actually handed it by a publisher of mine, an article by you that had appeared in LA Weekly, where you were quoted as talking about what the consequences were from Three Mile Island, which was the first time I became aware of what I was up against. And it seemed that at that time, you were everywhere. You were the person the media turned to. How did that happen? How did they find you? Was this primarily because of the book?
I think so. And I'd been interviewed by the Boston Globe. I can't remember how it actually happened. I think because of the book, also because of publicity, I was on various television stations. And the book was out. And then Three Mile Island happened. And then I was asked down to Harrisburg to speak to an auditorium full of very, very frightened people. And 60 Minutes filmed that. So I was on television, national television, talking about the medical consequences. And I had a fair bit of publicity after that relating to Three Mile Island, teaching people what it meant, the medical consequences.
And you were perhaps the only one who was out there and speaking of it, let alone having that large and substantial a platform to speak from. Scared the bejesus out of me, but at the same time told me areas where I had to take care of my health and planted the seeds for what became my activism. And I'm certain I'm not the only one who had both a fear response and then a what can I do about it response.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Everyone should know. And that's what I've done. I've been practicing global preventive medicine all my life, teaching people, like, it's, you're all my patients, and you have to understand what the medical implications are of this technology and everything else related to your body.
And this is particularly an area that does not get discussed or is not taken seriously.
Well, because the nuclear industry is so powerful and they started up peaceful nuclear power, the Pentagon said at the time that it was to divert people's fear and attention about nuclear weapons if it was peaceful. And it's not peaceful at all. And nuclear power plants create massive amounts of radioactive waste, which must be isolated from the ecosphere for 1 million years, according to the EPA, and that's a physical impossibility. Nuclear power plants emit tritium continuously. Children who live within 5 miles, I think, of a nuclear power plant have double the incidence of leukemia, and that's 3 studies from Britain, France, and Germany. They're very horrendous carcinogenic units, and they say it's clean. It's the most dangerous technology ever invented, ever, and will lead to the future of epidemics of cancer, leukemia, genetic disease, and congenital deformities for the rest of time as this hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive waste leak and infiltrate into underground water systems, bioconcentrate in food chains, in milk and cows, etc. And it's not just us that develop congenital abnormalities and genetic deformities and cancer, it's plants and animals too. So we're producing random compulsory genetic engineering for the rest of time with nuclear power. So they say it's clean. The reason they are so powerful is that, you know, E equals MC squared, that's very powerful. And in the military, the men talk about having nuclear war like one big orgasmic wump. They talk about missile rectors, soft laydowns, deep penetrations. So it's a sort of powerful testosterone simile, E equals MC squared. And, of course, almost all politicians are scientifically and medically illiterate. And these people who own the bomb, and we're right on the verge of nuclear annihilation today, the red carpet's laid down in Congress and they get whatever they, to use an Australian expression, whatever they bloody well want. And I'll get on to the quotes defense industry soon, but it's not defense, it's murder. It's the Department of Murder, not defense. Murder. All these weapons they're creating, they're for murder. Murder. Why don't we talk about, use proper English? Defense. Absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish.
With your concentration on nuclear matters, especially in the wake of your book and Three Mile Island, yet at the same time, you are a physician, a pediatrician, and specializing in dealing with cystic fibrosis. How did you balance the time between the two, and when did nuclear begin to predominate?
I did both together, really. I mean, I was working 80 hours a week at the hospital training to be a pediatrician. And the most calls that the hospital telephone switchboard got were about French tests and me. They threatened to fire me, the administration, but they didn't. So I was doing both. I would see my patients, run up to my room, take off my white coat, have a television interview, run back and see my patients again. So I was doing both at the same time. And then ready with a cap, ready to get the film and fly it over to Sydney and play it on national television. I did both at the same time.
Besides the hospital talking about but not following through on firing you, what other kinds of pushback did you get as you became progressively more visible?
Well, you know, the hospital superintendent got me to meet with a man. I suppose he was a physicist. I didn't know. I was talking about uranium mining, and he called me a Luddite. I'd never heard of a Luddite. I didn't know what a Luddite was. And through the retrospectoscope, how dare he say that to me? But they were on my back right from the start because they knew I was getting through to people. I think they knew that what I was saying was true, and they didn't want people to hear the truth.
While you were working in Boston, you became involved with what at that time was a small local group of Boston doctors.
Yeah, there was a group in Boston that started in the early 60s against nuclear weapons called Physicians for Social Responsibility. And they produced two wonderful articles in the New England Journal of Medicine about a bomb dropping on Boston and the medical effects. And it was very powerful, but they fought amongst each other and died. The organisation died. Now, what happened was a young man called Ira Helfand, who was a doctor in the local Cambridge City Hospital, came to me to see me when I was working at Harvard because there was a referendum to be held in Harvard about cancelling anything to do with nuclear power and isotopes. And he wanted some help. And so I turned to him as we talked and I said, Ira, this is a medical issue. Let's start a medical organization. Well, the week after, there was a meeting in my house and there was a guy called Dr. Richard Feinblum, who'd previously been a secretary for Physicians for Social Responsibility in the early 60s. And he said, look, it's still registered in the state of Massachusetts. It's dead. It hasn't operated for a long time. But let's see if we can use it, then we don't have to go through the formalities. And we could use it. And so we called ourselves PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility. We brought in some of the old people who originally formulated it, and they turned out to be very difficult. They didn't like me because I was a woman. And in the end, they they got rid of me, actually, but after a long time. So successful were we that I took in an ad for the New England Journal of Medicine about the dangers of nuclear power, which I put together myself, and it was published the day after Three Mile Island melted. Serendipity. So we got hundreds and hundreds of new members. We were operating out of a sort of a broom cupboard in Harvard Square in one of the doctor's medical practices, and we grew exponentially. And I was on television all the time. Because of Three Mile Island. That's actually how it happened through the New England Journal of Medicine and the like. In the end, we had 23,000 physicians who belonged. We had 123 chapters. I traveled all over the country servicing the chapters, teaching them how to talk on television, how to write op-ed pieces and the like. We held symposia on the medical consequences of nuclear war at Harvard, Stanford, I mean, all over the country, in all the major cities, and they were packed. And we got a huge amount of publicity from them, and people started to understand what the Cold War means, and it became very powerful. And at one of the symposia, I spoke, and a woman came up to me afterwards, and she said, I'm an agent for Hollywood film stars. I'd like to work with you. I said, I can't afford you. She said, I'll do it for free. Sally Field, Lily Tomlin, Tom Cruise, all of these people were her clients. So no one wants a boring old medical doctor talking about nuclear war on television, but if they've got Sally Field along with me or whoever, then that's great. And so she put me on with the film stars on television and radio, in Vogue, in Life, in women's magazines all over the country. And so as I was on television, I was speaking to Mr. and Mrs. Joe Sixpack, sitting with their kids watching television. So through that mechanism, over 80% of Americans started to understand what nuclear war means. And then a film was made called The Day After, which it was a bomb dropping on a Midwestern town. Everyone watched it. People had psychologists ready to counsel children because it was so scary. It was a film that helped turn Ronald Reagan around. I was asked to speak in the Playboy Mansion before all the film stars in Hollywood. Paul Newman was there to speak with me. I'd never met him. I walked into the Playboy Mansion and he kissed my hand and I nearly collapsed at his feet. He was so beautiful. Anyway, my agent said, look, these are film stars. You can be emotional tonight. Normally when I gave a speech to like 2,000 people, I'd have to be extremely scientific and establish my credentials. And only at the end could I go for their emotions and talk about how much do they love their children and smell a rose and the like. But this time I was quite emotional. I said at the end, go out and look up at the stars tonight and realize that we're probably the only life in the universe. Well, apparently Chris Christopherson had collapsed in my arms weeping at the end of my talk. I can't remember that. But also this tall, skinny girl came up to me and said, I'm Patty Davis. I think you're the only person on earth who can convince my father about nuclear weapons. And she was Reagan's daughter. Will you see him? I did a quick double take and I said, I'll see him, but alone, without me, Baker or Diva. And so she rang me the next day and said, we've got an hour at the end of his working day. And I said, what time is that? She said, 4 o'clock, which alarmed me a little. We had lunch, swept into the Southern Portico, went into the downstairs library in which there was no books. He came in all dithery, didn't know where to sit. I shook his hand and said, how do you do, Mr. President? So I showed him where to sit and we talked for an hour and a quarter. Patty sat there, but I was alone with him. I had longer time with him alone than any other person during his presidency. He started off by, oh, I said, I suppose you don't know who I am. And he said, yes, you're an Australian. You read on the beach and you're scared of nuclear war. And I said, yes. And he said, I too am scared of nuclear war, but a way to prevent it is to build more nuclear weapons. So we were off to a flying start. I'd just written my book, Missile Envy, and I had figures and facts just pouring out of me. And so he'd get quite uptight when he'd make a remark and I would correct him. So I ended up holding his hand, developing a doctor-patient relationship with him for about half the time, just reassuring him, teaching him. At the end, I thought, well, I haven't had any influence at all. But after that, he started saying nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won. I think it was partly the result of the film the day after, partly the result of me. He mentioned me as in his autobiography. And Nancy Reagan was onto it too. And in the end, he and Gorbachev met in Reykjavik in Iceland. And over a weekend, two mere mortals almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons. But they got stuck up on Star Wars. And Gorbachev should have said to Reagan, have Star Wars, because he knew it wouldn't work. But they got stuck on Star Wars and the whole thing fell apart. I remember Secretary of Defense Schultz came out from the meeting and he said, we did this and we achieved that and we achieved this. And then his face fell and then he said, it didn't work. I later went to Reykjavik and the people took me to that little house. It was a little house and they'd cleared the area for about a mile around and there were men standing with guns all around to protect it. Reagan and Gorbachev met in one room, Schultz and Shevardnadze in the other room. Upstairs was Richard Pearl, the Prince of Darkness, who worked in the Pentagon. And so Reagan would run into Schultz and give him talk about what had been proposed. Schultz would run up to Richard Pearl in the bathroom, who's writing numbers on lavatory paper because he didn't have any paper. And then they'd come down and downstairs were the KGB, and I don't know, I suppose they were drinking vodka, and someone threw a lighted match into the rubbish tin and it caught fire and they nearly burnt the whole place down. I've got that story straight from the horse's mouth. Amazing, eh? Amazing.
We'll continue with this comprehensive interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott in just a moment. But first, the International Uranium Film Festival begins next week on Navajo Nation in Window Rock, Arizona. taking place November 13th and 14th, before moving on to Las Vegas, November 21st through 23rd. I can't wait. The IUFF has become an annual ingathering of filmmakers, film lovers, activists, community members, and those involved in the ongoing struggles of the Navajo people against nuclear. What are they up against? Preventing the trucking of radioactive uranium on their roads, getting the government to clean up abandoned uranium mines that are still radioactive, cleaning up the still radioactive aftermath of the 1979 Church Rock uranium tailings pond spill, dealing with downwinder health issues, and spreading the word about RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, to compensate those harmed by the government's nuclear activities. That's why the IUFF Festival and its films are not just films. They are cornerstones in the ongoing struggle to inform and motivate people to join us in getting rid of all forms of this dangerous technology. And that's just like Nuclear Hot Seat is not just a podcast. It's a cornerstone in activist communications, spreading word of who we are, what we're doing, why we're doing it, what we're up against, and what each of us can do to help. All this while cheering on every activist, every action, every win, so the movement stays in good heart. Traveling to cover nuclear events is an important part of my work with Nuclear Hot Seat. As I have for the past three incarnations of the IUFF in Navajo Nation, I intend to bring you all the excitement, the films, the interviews with filmmakers, and talks with Indigenous leaders who are on the front lines. But with only 1 week until I need to leave, I am still in fundraising mode to cover the expenses. So if you are able to help me get to Window Rock to cover the events for Nuclear Hot Seat, please make a donation. It's easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. You can also send money directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and that way, no fees are taken out. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Whatever you can do to help, know that I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now back to this week's special featured interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott.
All our work to that point, and you know, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, I started medical organizations in almost every country in Europe, in Japan, in New Zealand, all over the world, and someone brought them all together. I didn't think of that, but a guy called Bernard Laun did, and he lobbied for the Nobel Prize. At the same time, Linus Pauling had nominated me for the Nobel Prize. He said, don't lobby them. They don't like to be lobbied. Well, Laun lobbied, used my work that I'd done, marginalized me, and got the prize to hang around his neck. We are all Nobel laureates, in fact, and I'm the one who did most of the work, but I was ostracized. I didn't even go to the Nobel ceremony. So that's what happens to women sometimes.
We do the work and we don't get the acknowledgement.
Yeah, he stole my work. In fact, he's just died, and I wrote to him just before he died, and I said, you stole my work. Anyway, he didn't reply, but that pisses me off.
You have this history of being phenomenally successful in terms of disability starting groups. You started another group, the Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament.
I actually called it Women's Party for Survival, and people said, you can't start another party in this country. We've only got two. But I should have stuck to it because it would have been very, very powerful. So we called it Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament WAND. And that's been very powerful too.
Does the group still exist?
Yes. And they've got a group that lobbies in Congress. They've got quite a lot of Congress women belonging to it. It's not as effective and powerful as it could be, or I wanted it to be. And unfortunately, I've left the States now, so it's not doing the work I wanted it to do. And when the Cold War ended, they changed the name to Women's Action for New Directions instead of Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament. And I said, don't do that. But now here, look at us now. After all the work we did and nearly getting to abolition of nuclear weapons between Russia and America, we're on the verge of extinction now. And someone said, what do you want on your tombstone? She tried and she failed. It's the truth. And in fact, Gorbachev's just been interviewed and they said, what do you want on your tombstone? I tried.
But he wouldn't admit the other part of it.
Apparently not. Just really pisses me off, I have to tell you. Really, I mean, I just look out my window at my roses and the rosellas and how could we destroy it? Just, and these bloody men who are military industrial complex who are stealing trillions of money from the American people, calling it defense. They've got factories in every congressional district. So if anyone think any vote comes up for weapons, everyone votes for it because it's jobs. Jobs for killing, jobs for murder. And no one calls it by its proper name. No one does. And then Putin is doing dreadful things to Ukraine, but America's done dreadful things since 9/11. It's killed nearly a million people, according to Brown University research. And it's got 800 bases in 80 countries. I mean, who does America think she is? She's metastasized like a cancer all over the world and killing people, killing. Think of all the children starving in Yemen. Think of this man who's just bought Twitter. He could feed all the children of the world. It just takes my breath away. And 52% of the population are women. That's us. And we're full of nurturing hormones, not testosterone. And yet we have no place. 52% of the Congress should be composed of women and every other corporation in the world. Why do we stand back? Why are we so pathetic? Remember Lysistrata, the Greek play?
Yes, I do.
Fighting and killing, and the women said, no sex. In fact, there's a country in Africa where that happened. And guess what? The men stopped fighting and killing because sex seems to be more important to them than killing each other and us. There was another very interesting, Libby, experiment. There's a woman in, I think, Los Angeles or San Francisco who was measuring hormones, a scientist, and she noticed when there was an altercation in the lab, the men would go into their room and slam the door and sort of fume. And the next morning, the women would come in, clean the benches, make coffee, try and make everything. So she did the hormone levels. The men's testosterone went sky high. In the event of this fight, altercation, women's oxytocin went up. Now, when you have a baby and you breastfeed, oxytocin is the hormone that is nurturing. I felt when I breastfed my babies, I could feed the whole world. I used to have dinner parties and fall asleep in the soup because I was so tired. And if you inject by aerosol oxytocin in men's nostrils, they become more nurturing and loving and caring. That's the hormone for survival.
In 2008, you founded the Helen Caldicott Foundation for a Nuclear-Free Future. What was the thinking behind that, and what were you hoping to accomplish with it?
All I did was give Linda and Paul Gunter my 501c3 because I already had an organization, a 501c3, and I'd almost finished. I'd held symposia at the New York Academy of Medicine on Fukushima, on the threat of nuclear war. Two books came out of that, Sleepwalking to Armageddon and Crisis Without End. It was about Fukushima. So I held these symposia, and it was the Helen Caldicott Foundation for a Nuclear-Free Future or something like that.
The Helen Caldicott Foundation for a Nuclear-Free Future.
Oh, okay. And so when I'd finished the work I had to do about nuclear power and Fukushima and Chernobyl and threat of nuclear war, I came back to Australia and I gave my 501c3 to Linda and Paul, who've been absolutely magnificent. Paul met me first when we marched in New Hampshire to the site where they were to build Seabrook. And I had a loudspeaker and I stood on the mound where they were to build Seabrook and spoke about the medical dangers of plutonium. And that turned Paul on, and he's been on it ever since.
When you learned about Chernobyl, what was your response and what actions did you take in terms of the media speaking out, raising awareness about the dangers that it represented?
Now, what date did Chernobyl occur? Can you remember?
Yeah, that was April 26th, 1986.
Now, when Chernobyl occurred, I'm trying to think. I can't remember my reaction to Chernobyl, but Alexei Yablokov, who wrote The Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and the Environment, Chernobyl, absolutely fantastic book. It's signed by him. He's dead now. Says, "Dear and wonderful Helen, with admiration and the best wishes." In the end, it was estimated at the time it was published, which is years ago, that 1 million people had already died from Chernobyl in Europe. 40% of Europe is radioactive and will continue to be for the rest of time. I don't buy European food. Turkey got such a fallout, it sent all its radioactive tea to Moscow. It was so angry, but Turkey's still very radioactive. Do not buy any Turkish food. I don't think I held a symposium on Chernobyl per se.
You did hold, through the Helen Caldicott Foundation, two symposia. This was after Fukushima. The first one was in 2012, and it was the Symposium on the Medical and Ecological Impacts of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident. This was a massive two-day undertaking with international experts brought in.
Yeah.
What motivated you to do it, and what did it take for you to pull this together?
Well, it was imperative that we put together the data on Fukushima and extrapolate it into the future about what it would mean, could mean, and did mean, and to advertise the consequences so people knew about it. It didn't get as much publicity as I had wanted, but certainly it was very powerful, and the book came out of it called Crisis Without End, which has been used a lot by people. You know, Hillary Clinton signed a deal just after Fukushima saying that she would not prevent any food coming in from Japan, that would be all fine. The Fukushima prefecture became very radioactive, so they dilute radioactive rice with non-radioactive rice and sell it abroad. I've just been on television in South Korea because they're terrified because the Japanese want to empty 1.4 million tons of radioactive water into the Pacific. And so I've been talking about how those radioactive elements bioconcentrate by orders of magnitude in each step of the food chain, from crustaceans, big fish, from algae, crustaceans, big fish, little fish, us, how all of the isotopes are invisible, tasteless and odorless, how it takes up to 50 years to develop cancer once you've inhaled or ingested any of these isotopes, as they irradiate a small volume of cells for many years, inducing mutations in regulatory genes, and then a cancer develops, which is an unregulated cellular growth. It's just ongoing. And the Pacific's a big ocean, and I live on the Pacific here in Australia. So I could eat a fish here, you know, although I'm nearly 84, it won't affect me now, but that has been contaminated from Fukushima. The tuna in California are carrying isotopes from Fukushima. It's an absolute total disaster. It's never ending. Three reactors melted down. They will never decommission it. It's so radioactive, none of the workers can get near the melted fuel. It will never be fixed, ever, ever. So I felt it was terribly important that everyone learned about Fukushima, and we put together the data in a book that could be referenced for the rest of time.
That's Crisis Without End.
Yes.
We will, of course, link to all of your publications on the website page for this under Nuclear Hot Seat. You're saying that the mainstream media did not pay attention to what you were doing with the symposium or the information you were putting out?
No, not interested. No. You know, this is a medical issue. It's a medical issue. If there was one case of rabies in New York, it would be headlines in the New York Times.
You also produced a second symposium. This was in 2015, which was The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction. This was a seminar where, for the first time, I learned about nuclear winter, along with many other things.
Oh, really? Oh, really?
Yes. My educational curve has been steep since Fukushima. And people asked me when I came back from the symposium, they said, did you have a good time? And I said, well, I came back sick, depressed, and nauseous because the information was so clear and so impactful and so overwhelming in terms of spelling out the fact that we did and do face possible nuclear extinction. Explain, if you would, briefly, nuclear winter. And what it is and what could trigger it.
Well, first of all, I'll tell you why I held a symposium. Who was the physicist who had ALS and was totally paralyzed but brilliant?
Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking said soon before that symposium that they're going to use artificial intelligence. They're using it now in the Pentagon with their weapons, nuclear weapons, et cetera. And he said that it's almost certain we'll have a nuclear war within 10 years. And I thought, my God, started by artificial intelligence with no human input. So that's why I held the symposium. Now, nuclear winter. America's got about 3,000 hydrogen bombs. Russia's got about 3,000. China's got 250. India and Pakistan have got some. France has got some. Britain's got some. But Russia and America are the main ones. Many of the hydrogen bombs are on missiles in America and Russia, and they're on hair trigger alert, meaning there's a base in Australia called Pine Gap, which looks at the sky the whole time. And if it detects missiles coming from Russia, which take half an hour to go from where to go, then the Pine Gap alerts the Pentagon, and within that half an hour, the weapons are launched in America, and they take half an hour to go to Russia. And the president has a three-minute decision time whether or not to launch. There are two men in each missile silo. There are about 400 silos, I think, in the Midwest, each armed with a pistol, one to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behavior. They operate by floppy disks. Their telephones sometimes don't work. They take drugs down there, or even when they're on leave and come back to work. And they're aged like about 23 or thereabouts, and they're the ones who press the button and off the weapons go. The president, always walking beside him, is an officer with a suitcase called the football with the mechanism to initiate a nuclear war. When Reagan was shot, they lost the suitcase. So things are very, very tenuous, and they have 3 minutes to decide whether or not to launch. And the nuclear war has almost taken place many times by a flock of geese, misunderstood by the radars, or a rising moon, or America launched a weather satellite in Norway that informed the Kremlin, but the Kremlin lost the data. They saw this satellite going up. They thought for sure that's going to be a first strike on Moscow and knock out Putin. And they got ready to launch until they just at the last minute found out it was a weather satellite. That sort of thing goes on all the time, all the time. We're on the edge of annihilation every minute of every day, but it's much worse now. Now, there were about 12 hydrogen bombs targeted on New York City, on each of the bridges, a couple on each airport, I mean, the major centers, each had a bomb targeted on. The targeting strategy was done by a lower level officer in the Pentagon. It was like pinning the tail on the donkey for Russia. Now, so all the major cities in Russia are targeted, all the major cities, universities and the like are targeted in America, and we'll just take those two countries. So as a bomb drops on New York or high in the air, the temperature inside the bomb is, I don't know, can't remember, but it's 20 to 100 times greater than the temperature inside the sun. It causes a firestorm of 3,000 square miles. And when the Pentagon estimated the dangers and the results of a nuclear war, they never took into account fire, only blast. But it's fire that really does it. And the temperatures are so hot that human beings are vaporized. If you're 200 miles away and look at the flash, you'll be instantly blinded by retinal burns. Eyeballs melt and fall out of you on your face. Concrete and steel are vaporized. And then the firestorms would unite across the country, burn east to west coast, north to south. And in every city, there's a huge stockpile of carboniferous material like oil and coal, and huge amounts of stuff to burn. And as this huge cloud of toxic black radioactive smoke rises up into the stratosphere, it stays there for up to 10 years, blocking out the sun and causing temperatures to fall to below zero. And it's called nuclear winter, an ice age. Everything, everyone, and every plant would die. That's nuclear winter. Actually, a symposium was held way back in the 80s with Carl Sagan et al. Nuclear winter was first explored at that time. And my editor at W.W. Norton, Mary Kinane, produced a book from that called The Cold in the Dark. And we've known about nuclear winter for a long time.
How many nuclear bombs going off would it take to trigger nuclear winter? Approximately.
It's not very many. I can't remember the exact number, but it's about 200. For instance, a Trident submarine has 96 nuclear weapons on it. 96. And there are 16 Trident submarines, each more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. Each Trident submarine can produce the equivalent of about 1,000 Hiroshimas. Oh, the United States has 14 Trident submarines, and that's only half the arsenal because the rest are on land. The Russians have as many nuclear weapons. We did a simulation of what would happen if the US and Russia had a nuclear war. A lot more smoke would go into the atmosphere. It would cause a much greater temperature change of 7 to 8 degrees Celsius colder. The person who's written about this is Ira Helfand, who helped me found PSR.
So here we are with the situation in Ukraine. Suddenly, it is Russia invading Ukraine, the United States, all of the EU, NATO are getting involved with this. There's a lot of nuclear saber rattling, but there's also the nuclear dangers on the ground from Russia's invasion. You've said several times during this interview that we are on the edge of annihilation. Talk to us about the situation as you see it in Russia now.
Yes, there are 15 nuclear reactors in the Ukraine, including Chernobyl. If the Second World War was fought today in Europe, Europe would be uninhabitable for the rest of time because it would be so radioactive, uninhabitable. The Russian soldiers, over 1,000 of them, camped by Chernobyl, digging trenches, burning the wood for fires, extremely radioactive. And almost all those soldiers now are suffering from acute radiation illness. They've had so much radiation that kills their blood cells, so they can't stop bleeding. They develop hemorrhages, vomiting, diarrhea, and infection because the white blood cells die too. And they'll die within a few weeks of acute radiation illness. Then they went to another nuclear power plant, and I can't pronounce the name, but it begins with Z.
Zaporizhia.
And they hurled missiles into that reactor. It's unbelievable what they've been doing through sheer ignorance. Luckily, the power supply was still intact, but there could have been a meltdown there. There are 15 reactors. You can't have a war where there are nuclear reactors and missiles and like, but that's what's happening in the Ukraine. So it could cause Europe to become uninhabitable, millions dying of acute radiation illness, millions getting cancer later. I mean, Chernobyl on a massive scale.
There is much more to this interview with Dr. Helen Caldicott, which is why originally it was published as two separate shows. We will have links up to both of them
episodes number 568 and 569 on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 749. We will also have links up to her work and her books. Dr. Caldicott currently lives back in Australia, where she has been known to sit in her backyard and enjoy her roses. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 4th, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, it's the best way to make certain you don't miss a single episode. Set it up by going to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a yellow box that pops up. You can't miss it. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get just one email. We don't bug you. It will contain the link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of the content. Meanwhile, you can help us if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview. Send us that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, especially as I'm headed off to Window Rock for the International Uranium Film Festival, thank you, and know that any amount will help, and we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, the only world that is safe from nuclear weapons is a world without nuclear weapons. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.